this devil has a vendetta against God. He is totally prepared to sacrifice and do whatever he can in order to go against what God wants and what God's desire is. And he wants to destroy all who are godly, whatever it might be. So Peter goes on there in verse 8, and he says to us that because we know this being is out there, this enemy, that we ought to be sober and we ought to be very vigilant in our lives, being aware of what is going on. So I wonder, in the next two sermons today and in the next sermon on November the 14th, we want to delve into the subject of the devil, of who he is, what he is. Today, I would like to cover the origin of this evil genius. How did he come into existence? And if God is the creator of all things, did God create the devil? When did this evil being, this arch enemy of God, come into being? And how did he come into being? How did he wind up in the position where he is, along with his cohorts? And maybe even more importantly, why does God allow him to continue to exist? Why is he roaring? And why is he roaming around? Would God be capable of taking him out of the way? I dare say he would be able to do that if he wanted to. So there must be a reason why God allows him to continue to roam this earth, and what allowed to be doing the things he is doing. And then on November the 14th, in the next sermon, we will ask and answer the questions about God's relationship to human beings. And if Satan is God's arch enemy, how does he go about trying to devour us? How does he do that? What are his tactics? What stratagems does he use? And what can we then do to avoid being devoured? What can we do in our lives to avoid becoming a prey? And so today on the history and on the origins of this powerful being, we will concentrate on that today, and then in the next sermon on November the 14th, we will cover his strategies, what he and how he works in our lives. But today we want to cover his origins. Once upon a time, many years ago, God brought into being the whole world and the universes. All that we see around us in the heavens above, in the earth below, and in the waters under the waters. God created the deep space, which man is bringing closer and closer to us, as you see some of the images that are being brought back from satellites and from NASA's experiments going on. We are seeing images that are absolutely phenomenal about part of God's creation out there, right? Incredible pictures from as far away as Pluto and on beyond that they are now able to take pictures of and relay back to us. That mankind would not even have been able to dream about what was out there and what it looked like. God made it all at one time. We are told in Isaiah 45 about this creation that God created. In Isaiah, the 45th chapter, God fills us in on a little bit of the details about his creation and what he did. In Isaiah 45 and verse 18, it says, "For thus says the Eternal that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He has established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Eternal and there is none else." Now when and what period of time is God referring to? Somewhere in the way in the past, right? That God says he created. The Hebrew word for created is bara. Comes out of Strong's Concordance number 1254, if you want to look it up, bara. It is a primary root which means to create or to cut down as wood, to select, to feed, or as a formative process, to choose, create, cut down, dispatch, do, and make. So God said he created it in a certain way. And then going on, he says that he did not create it in vain. Now, the Hebrew word for in vain is 84:14, which is the word tohu, actually. And it is, from Strong's Concordance, he says, from an unused root meaning to lie waste, a desolation of surface, that is a desert, and figuratively a worthless thing. Adverbially, it means in vain, confusion, empty, or an empty place, without form, nothing, not, vain, vanity, waste, and wilderness. So God says when he created the world that it was created not in tohu and bohu, actually, but that it was formed to be inhabited. I am the Eternal and there is none other. I think probably, I'm not saying there are not other groups that understand to some degree about the creation that went on. I haven't checked all peoples and all churches. But I would say the church is one of the few organizations who really understand that the recreation in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2 on was not the original creation. That it was a second creation after something had happened that took a perfect universe, a perfect world, a perfect inhabitable world and turned it into tohu and bohu. We'll go back to Genesis 1 in a few minutes. So who was the one who did this and caused what God said he created to be established? It was created not in waste, but he formed it to be an inhabited world. He formed it for a purpose and a reason. We find in the book of Job that during this original creation time, there was an audience watching. And they shouted for joy when they saw what God did. In the book of Job, chapter 38, in God's challenge to Job, bringing him to the point where he recognized who God really was, and he says in Job 38, verses 4, beginning of verse 4, and he asks Job a few questions. And he says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" That's a pretty big question. I'm sure he wasn't there. It's all right. "Declare if you have understanding. And who has laid the measures thereof, if you know? Or who has stretched the line upon it?" Did he, like a carpenter, have a line that he put across it? And how did he do it? Job, you tell me. You know about construction. Where were you? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? If there is a cornerstone of the world, you know, who laid it? But he said in verse 7, so when the morning stars sang together, and all of the sons of God shouted for joy. At that time of that creation, when God created the universe and the vast realms of space and everything else, that there was an audience who were so thrilled that it says that they sang together as the sons of God. They were shouting for joy at what God had done and was doing. And this creation was perfect. And all of the angels were joyous at what had happened. You know who one of those angels was at that time? The one who became Lucifer or Satan, an adversary. He was there also, shouting for joy at what God had done and what God had made. Going back to Genesis chapter 1 then, in Genesis first chapter, where we read about the establishment of the worlds that we see around us today, it says in verse 1, in the beginning, and you and I do not know when that was. Somewhere there was a beginning, however, right? We don't know how long ago that was. I dare say the beginning was probably millions, if not billions, of years ago that God created all that was created. We don't know how long ago it was. If you take scientific evidence today, they are putting the age of the earth at, what, some billions of years old, right? And I'm not saying scientists are always right. But unfortunately, there are some who try to put all of geology and creation into, in quote, 6,000 years. That's a pretty hard thing to do. When you look at the geological formations and you look at all the things that have gone on in the world and in the universe, it's pretty hard to contract that down into a 6,000-year period of time. And God doesn't say it happened in 6,000 years of time. What he says is that man has been here for 6,000 years, give or take, right? Mankind. Not the worlds that we see around us. So God says here that in the beginning, whenever that was back there somewhere in the way past, God created, by the way, the same word, bara. He created in perfection. He created to be inhabited. He created a universe that was perfect in every way. And he created the heavens and the earth. But then you find in verse 2 that, and the earth became, and the word was, should be, became actually. There are other places in the book of Genesis where you will find the word translated was as became. For example, Genesis 19 and verse 26, where he says in Genesis 19 and verse 26, talking about the time of Sodom and Gomorrah, and of Lot's wife, he says in verse 26, but his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Same word translated was in the book of Genesis chapter 1. There are other examples of it also, but from all putting everything together, as you will see as we go along by deduction, that we recognize that the earth and much of the universe, as far as that goes, became tohu and bohu, without form and void. Now, we just read in Isaiah 45 and verse 18 that God did not create the world in tohu and bohu, right? That was not the way he did it. And yet in Genesis 1 and verse 2, it says, and the earth became without form, or in tohu, and void, bohu, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And then we find in the rest of Genesis chapter 1 a re-establishment, a reordering of the systems and the solar system and all of the rest of the things that happened after something caused chaos. Something happened between verses 1 and verse 2 that brought about a changed world from what God had first made. And it became a universe that had no form, and it was void. So the world words without form and void are in the same Hebrew words, tohu, that's T-O-H-U-W, and bohu, B-O-H-U-W. It says bohu means from an unused root meaning to be empty, a vacuity. That is superficially an undistinguishable ruin, emptiness and void. That comes from Strong's Concordance. So here we find a world totally different from the world we read about in Isaiah 45 and verse 18, right? Two different worlds. What happened? Well, first thing is that there is an indeterminate length of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, of which we do not know how long it was. A time when something happened. We get an insight into some of the things that happened, but there was a length of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2 that this planet and the whole universe became formless, and it became void or not inhabitable. Okay? And yet we saw in Job 38 that the angels were already in existence. So sometime prior to his creating of, in Isaiah 45 verse 18, God had already created the angelic beings. How long ago? I don't know. They were created prior to the universe as we know it today, because they were there as an audience when God created the universe in perfection. Interesting, back in the book of Peter, in 2 Peter, that Peter gives a chronological listing of the differing events that have happened in the book of 2 Peter, and verse chapter 2. And he talks about that there were false prophets among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, and they've done all these destructive things. And many shall follow their pernicious ways, verse 2. Verse 3, through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you. By the way, it sounds like what Satan is supposed to be doing. If you go back to the book of Revelation chapter 20 and chapter 12 and other places. But through covetousness shall they make with feigned words make merchandise of you with judgment now. Whose judgment now for a long time lingers not, and their damnation slumbers not. And then he gives a list. For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell or Sheol, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved into judgment. So here we find in this listing, chronological listing, by the way, the first in order of this, of rebellion against God is the rebellion of the angelic beings. And again, I can't give you a date for that. I can't tell you when that exactly happened, but Peter puts in this chronological listing that there was, prior to the Noachian flood, somewhere back there, that there was a rebellion of the angels that sinned. Over in the book of Job, you will find them called those who did not or left their first estate. They left their responsibility. They left what they were supposed to do. And they are reserved unto Tartaru. That's another word for hell, by the way. There are three words translated in the New Testament for the word hell. Tartaru is the least often used. In fact, I think it's only used twice in all of the Bible. It means a special place of darkness reserved for these angelic beings who were cast down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. Then second in order, we find that there's, and did not spare the old world, but saved Noah and the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. So the next in order of these catastrophes that happened, we find the Noachian flood of destruction upon the whole world, except for eight people who were survived, or did survive it. Then we find in verse 6, the third one of these situations in order, and they turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, and condemned them with an overflow, making them an example unto those that after should live ungodly. And he destroyed just Lot, vexed with the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them and seeing and hearing vexed his righteous life or soul from day to day with their ungodly, unlawful deeds. So we have all of these examples down through time of differing rebellions against God's system and God's way. The first one was the angelic world. Later on, we have human beings in the Noachian flood. So then how did the angels leave that first estate? How did they rebel? Interesting statement by Christ himself in the book of Luke, chapter 10. Where Christ was talking, he had just sent out his disciples to go to various cities and places and had given them authority over a lot of things. And coming on down to Luke chapter 10 and verse 17 and 18, he says, and the 70 then returned again with joy after they had gone out on these missionary trips going all the way around. And the Lord, even the with joy, saying, Lord or Master, even the devils are subject unto us through your name. And he said unto them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. What he was saying was, hey, if you really knew who I was there at the time Satan was thrown out of heaven. I was there and saw him fall as lightning after he resisted and rebelled against God and after he took upon himself authority that did not belong to him, after he no longer was willing to live by the laws of God. Now Christ here is implying that he has power over that being, right? Because he says, verse 18 and verse 19, Behold, I give unto you then power to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy. I have that power. I can transfer that power over to you that you can't have power over. All of this authority and this satanic world that's out there. Because I was there, I know why he was put down. So if all of the angels, including the one who becomes Satan, were there at the creation of the universe, what happened? And why does then Christ say he saw Satan fall from heaven? Well, we get a lot more of the insight into what went on and what happened by going back to a couple of Old Testament scriptures in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel chapter 28. That they fill in a lot of the details and fill in a lot of the gaps in what happened between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And yet, by putting a little bit here and a little bit there and putting it together, we can begin to deduce what actually happened. So let's go back to Isaiah 14, first of all. In Isaiah, the 14th chapter. Where hidden among all of the prophecies of the book of Isaiah, we pick up some very important information that we find in Isaiah 14 and beginning with verse 12. Now, it's interesting that this whole prophecy is relating to the king of Babylon, who was the epitome of power and authority. But this king, in quote, king of Babylon, was not necessarily just a human being. There was some other power that was beyond that, as we will find in Ezekiel 28, when it talks about the king of Tyre, that there was somebody behind that authority and that power that was not just another human being. So he says here in verse 12, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning?" Interesting that this one, at one time, was the son of the morning, or the day star, actually, the light bringer. So he says, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer," or light bringer, that's what the word means, "son of the morning, how are you cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations?" Then it goes on, verse 13 and so on some other things, but I'd like to just go through a list of the things that we can pick up from here. First of all, we find that Lucifer at one time was a light bringer. One who brought light. Second, we find that he was cut down to where? The ground. He was brought down to the ground. Thirdly, we find that this being weakens the nations. There is a cause for every effect. There is a cause why nations are weak. Why they have problems, or why they have wars. One of the primary causes of nations having weaknesses is by satanic influence and what he is doing in their lives. So he weakened the nations. Going on to verse 13, we find that, "For thou hast said in your heart," somewhere along the line, there came an evil thought that was motivated by a heart desire. "For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven." I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. So what are some of the things we can find in verse 13? That this one, this being, became proud and arrogant and haughty. Number 5, that he wanted to be above the other angels and other beings. He wanted to exalt himself above the other angelic world and become the boss, right? The authority. Number 6, he decides to exalt himself not only over the other angels, but to sit in the very domain of God, in the sides of the north, where God's throne is. He wants then to ascend even above the clouds. And verse number 8, he will be like the Most High. In verse 14, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will be like the Most High. Now, other translations will put that a little bit more clear, that he did not want to be just like the Most High. He wanted to be the Most High, okay? He didn't want to share the dominion with God. He wanted to be over God, telling God what to do and how to do it. And the ninth thing that we find in these verses is in verse 15, yet you shall be brought down to Sheol. You will be brought down to hell, to the very sides of the pit. That there's coming a time when this rebellion will be put away and will be resolved. So we fill in a little bit of the space and that indeterminable length of time, and we find that during that time, rebellion was going on. Hostility to God by one of his own created beings. Over in chapter 28 of the book of Ezekiel, we'll pick up a little bit more of the story of what this, the origins of the evil we see around us today. In Ezekiel 28 and verse 12, and it's interesting, if you go back to Ephesians chapter 6, where Paul tells us that Satan and his demons rule over the nations and over powers and over dominions and over principalities, right? That in all positions of authority and power, there are, what Paul said, there is a spiritual support system that's under or over. Okay. But in Ezekiel 28, we find that the story picks up with the king of Tyre in verse 28. Son of man, take up a lamentation about the king of Tyre and say unto him, thus says the eternal God, you seal up the sum full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Well, we found that when God made something and created things, in Isaiah 45 and verse 18, he made it perfect, right? He made these angelic beings perfect. So much so that he says here that this one, who we will find is the devil and Satan, that he was the sum total of wisdom. That's pretty wise, all right? Pretty wise. The sum, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. And then in verse 13 he says, and thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. So I'd like to just go down some of the things that we find in Ezekiel 28 in those few verses. And I've got them listed. One is that he sealed up the sum of wisdom and beauty. Two, he was in the Garden of Eden. So sometime, some way or the other, at the time of the creation, he was able to be there, right? In the garden, in Eden. He was covered with precious gems. He must have been a fantastically, beautifully decorated and covered individual. I mean, after all, if you want to, it must be a woman's envy to know that his covering was sardius and topaz and diamond and beryl and onyx and jasper and sapphire and emerald and carbuncle and gold. And the workmanship of his tabrets and of your pipes were prepared in you in the day that you were created. He didn't just wear a few diamonds. He had all kinds of things on him, decorating him. So he wore all kinds of precious gems. We find that he was, going on over, on down a little bit, in verse 16, we find it says that he was an anointed cherub that covered. And God appointed him that. He was an appointed, anointed cherub that covered. He was one of, if you go back to Exodus, and you'll find a picture of when they created or made the temple, which is a picture of what was in heaven, that there were covering cherubs whose wings covered the ark of God. Apparently, Lucifer, the one who became our adversary, was at one time one of those covering cherubs. You couldn't have anybody closer to the very power and throne of God than when he was. And yet he was not happy and satisfied with it. So we find that he was an anointed cherub that covers, and God set him so. God made him that way. In verse 14, you are the anointed cherub that covers. I have set you so. I put you in that position. So you were upon the holy mountain of God, and you walked up and down in the midst of the very power, throne of God among the fire. I can't imagine what God's throne looks like, except that it's revealed in the early chapters of the book of Ezekiel. So he was in the holy mountain of God. He walked up and down in the throne of God's presence. He was perfect, as it says, the next verse, that he was perfect from the time of his creation until iniquity was found in him. Again, I don't know how long that was. Nobody knows how much of that indeterminable period of time are we talking about. When did God finally detect, or put it a different way, when did Satan or Lucifer or this covering cherub finally reveal his true nature? When did it finally come out? How long in that process of time? You know, it takes a long time. This is one of the things we'll get to next week when we get into the stratagems of Satan. There's one thing about Satan is he is not impatient. He is extremely patient to finally deal with what he wants. He's willing to sit along the sidelines for a long time until he finds the best moment to do his evil deed. How long was he perfect until iniquity was found? I mean, some of us have been around God's church now for 50, 60 years, and we think, man, we have shown our true character for all this time. How long did Satan show his, you know, that he was smart and he was wise before iniquity was found in him? That's one of the things I've always been amazed at when troubles come in God's church. It's not always just the new people that are troubled, is it? Many times it's people have been around for a long, 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 long time. Well, Lucifer had been around for a long, long, long time until he really revealed himself. How did he really reveal himself? How did God finally detect this chink in the armor of Satan? How did he finally detect that this being that he had created was not perfect in character? He was perfect in outward substance. He was perfect in what God was able to make, but he was not perfect in character. Because Satan, well, to put it this way, because God himself cannot create perfect character. He can create perfect things around, but what's inside, to live by the way of God, the laws of God, that's why we are in the church today, is to learn that and to prove that we are not like Satan, that we will sooner or later show our chink in the armor and become like Satan. Somewhere along the line will some of us suddenly get filled with envy, and we are not any longer willing to be where we are or where God has put us, even at the very throne of God in this case. But Satan was not satisfied with what God created him to do. So iniquity then was found in him. And in the process then, we find that he was then filled with violence. Oh, that's another one of the things we will learn, that Satan is filled with violence. He is an angry soul, okay, an angry being who will do anything to get revenge. And so what happens then, number 12, is that we find that God casts him as profane from the very mountain of God. And we find that God says that he will destroy him. That God will destroy him. All of this you will read in the next few verses there in Ezekiel 28. We find that his heart was lifted up because of his beauty. Because of his beauty. Sometimes we can get lifted up just like that. And his wisdom was corrupted. That's a very important point that we will talk a lot about next week, or at November 14th, is that sum of wisdom was corrupted. Some way or the other, it took a 90 degree or maybe 180 degree turn. No longer was it wisdom, it became the opposite. It became totally destructive. No longer was he an angelic being who covered God's very presence, but he became a violent, corrupted being. And finally, we find number 16 is that God cast him to the ground. Notice it says he was cast to the ground. All right? He was cast out of heaven. He was cast down to this earth. We find in Ephesians chapter 2, before I turn there, we'll turn to Ephesians 2 in a minute. But so what we find is then that Satan and his cohorts, the demons, we will find that he actually drew one third of the angels with him. But that this Satan and his demons and his cohorts are now relegated to the earth. But he is still has certain access to God. There is certain access, even though he was relegated to the earth, that he has still been allowed to have certain access to God and to his presence. We'll find that again a little later on. So what is Satan doing now? We find in Ephesians chapter 2 that Paul says in Ephesians, the second chapter, and verse 2, wherein in times past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. What else can a disobedient spirit do except to create a spirit of disobedience? That's his very character and his very nature, is one of disobedience to God. And he resists everything that is godly. He is that corrupted and that turned away from what one time he was. So he is now the prince of the power of the air, and he is now working in children of disobedience. We find back in the book of Job that he does have a certain amount of access to God. In the book of Job, we're told in this story and this account of one individual that there was a certain time that the sons of God, which we know are angelic beings in this case, but in Job, the first chapter in verses 6, he says, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, or the Eternal, and Satan came among them, or this adversary came along at a council meeting, okay, in heaven. And the Lord said to Satan, since he was there, God turns to him and says, oh, Satan, which means adversary, by the way. He says, where have you been? And Satan answers the Lord and said, oh, I've been going up and down, to and fro in the earth, from walking up and down in it. I've been doing my dirty business down there. I've been trying the best I can to meddle in everybody's affairs, and I've just been walking around watching what's going on. And then verse 8, he says, and so the Eternal said to Satan, well, in that walking up and down in the earth, have you considered my servant Job? Oh. I would hope that God doesn't say that about some of us sometimes, right? As Job goes up there, as Satan might go on council meetings, and he might say, well, have you seen my servant? I won't call any names, by the way. Okay. Well, he said, have you observed Job out there? Well, you know what? Satan had already seen him. He was already aware of it. And so the Lord said to Satan, well, have you considered my servant Job, and if there is none like him in the earth? Well, you know, there was none like Satan one time in heaven either, except for, you know, he was less than God. So he said, well, have you observed my servant Job, that there's nobody like him? He is perfect and an upright one that fears God and he hates evil. And Satan answers the Lord, and he said, well, you know what? Job doesn't do this for nothing. Has not you made a hedge about him and about his home and about all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and of his substance. You have given him the increase. I've seen all that. But let me tell you, I say that if you put forth your hand and you touch all that he has and you take away all that you have given to him, he will curse you to your face. You want another strategy of Satan? There it is. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. How would you like that to be said about you? All right, Satan, I'm turning all that he has over to you. He's in your hands. Except you cannot take his life. No. That's not too good of a picture. But we do find that he is able to go to the up to heaven yet. And sometimes will present himself. We find in Revelation 12, verses 5 to 6, that Satan wants to destroy God and his plan. He wants to destroy God and his plan. And Satan wants to deceive and has deceived the whole world. His mission is to destroy. His mission is to corrupt. His mission is to create violence. His mission is to create an atmosphere of disobedience, an attitude of disobedience, because that's who he is. And so we see then a great created being who was one of the covering cherubs, who allowed himself to be filled with envy. He allowed himself to be puffed up with pride. He exalted himself above the other angelic beings, and he even exalted himself before God. And he became a transformed being from what he was to what he is. He was transformed into a being who is bent on destruction, bent on violence, bent on death in every way possible. And so we see a creation perfect, the physical creation around that became tohu and bohu, formless and void, because of the rebellion of angelic beings. We see then an angelic being who wanted to usurp authority over God and to get into the very presence of God, and that he was relegated back down to this earth. So that's a little bit of the origins of that being who is there. It may not be kosher to believe there is a Satan. Christ did believe it, by the way. He exists. So next time, on November the 14th, we will pick up then that story of what Satan is doing today. What are his strategies? What are his tactics? How does he deal with us as human beings? What kind of influence does he have? And what are the limits of what he can and can't do? And we will also see then what the final fate of this rebellion will be. So tune in next time.